Thank you. Good morning. I'm Marcia Breckenridge, and I'm today's moderator. It's my very special pleasure to welcome you to the first Monadnock 2021 Summer Lyceum. Today's guest speaker is Richard Lederer. But before we get started, I'd like to thank today's musician, Eric Stumacher, who recorded the piano playing for you to enjoy while waiting for the live broadcast. I'd also like to thank the Royal Bank of Canada Wealth Management for generously sponsoring today's event. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as the catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported primarily through contributions from our audience. We deeply appreciate your donations, which this year may be made on our website by mailing your donations. And during this challenging time, we need your help more than ever. Today's talk is being recorded and will soon be available as a podcast and as a video on our website, monadnocklyceum.org. The talk will also be rebroadcast on WSMN next Sunday, July 4th at 7 a.m. and 4 p.m. and on WUML this Wednesday, July 30th at 10 a.m. Today, Dr. Lederer will entertain and inform us with a presentation on language. He has also graciously agreed to answer questions orally. We may not have time to answer all the questions orally, and so your questions can be typed into the chat for oral discussion or on YouTube or Facebook at monlyceum@gmail.com. Those that do not get answered can be addressed through email, and we will post that address to contact Dr. Lederer later. After the broadcast, you may provide feedback on today's program and offer suggestions for speakers or join our mailing list through our website. And now it is my pleasure to tell you some things about Dr. Lederer. I feel especially privileged to introduce Dr. Lederer today and feel as though he is an old friend, since my English classes often learned and laughed with material from two of my favorite of his books, Get Thee to a Punnery and Anguished English. Here are a few of my quotes from that Anguished English. In what other language do people drive in a parkway and park in a driveway? Or people play at a recital and recite at a play? Why in our crazy language can your nose run and your feet smell? If adults commit adultery, do infants commit infantry? In addition, Dr. Lederer has written over 50 books on language. Some of these include Comma Sense, A Fundamental Guide to Punctuation, A Man of My Words, Reflection on the English Language, The Cunning Linguist, Ribald Riddles, Lascivious Limericks, Carnal Corn, and Other Good, Clean, Dirty Fun. Two of his most recent works are A Treasury of Halloween Humor and A Treasury of Christmas Humor. A soon-to-be-published book is titled Richard Lederer's Ultimate Book of Literary Trivia. And in talking to my friend this morning, I learned an upgrade. The Dictionary of Amazing Words is being put out again, and he is working on a book called A Pleasury of Words and Phrase Origins with thematic clusters. That book is in progress. The Toadstool Bookstore in Peterborough is currently featuring many of his works, and I invite you to treat yourself and visit tomorrow.
And Marcia, they are signed, those books, do
we? Yes, they are. Yes, they are. In many ways, both the Lyceum and the Toadstool are home to our speaker, since New Hampshire was his home for many years. He received his PhD in linguistics from UNH, and at St. Paul's School in Concord, he coached and headed the English department for over two decades. He's also a familiar name as the writer of the syndicated column, Letterer on Language, which appears throughout the United States, and is a co-founding co-host of A Way with Words, heard on public radio. In addition to his regional fame, Dr. Letterer has been named International Punster of the Year and Toastmasters International Gavel Winner, and is a former usage editor of the Random House Dictionary of the English Language. Today, we are clearly welcoming home a favorite son whose wit and linguistic knowledge will provide an exciting beginning to the 2021 8-week Summer Lyceum. Stay tuned to a morning of language and laughter. Welcome, Dr. Letterer.
Marcia, who, by the way, is the woman who really made the connection, I would not be here. She is the sine qua non. But Richard Letterer here, 35 years and beyond, but 35 years in New Hampshire. Your resident fly by the roof of the mouth, user-friendly linguist, wizard of idiom, Attila the pun, Conan the grammarian, and I hope many of you know the most word-struck, word-besotted, word-be-thumped, wordaholic you will ever meet. And this is a morning of language and laughter. The committee and I agreed that as we're coming out of the apocalypse, the Armageddon, the time of pestilence, that some laughter, linguistic humor, in my case, would be the best balm. And humor, like that music and that marvelous music that preceded me, music hath charms to soothe the savage breast, often misquoted as a savage beast, William Congreve, about 100 years after Shakespeare, but it actually is a breast, not a beast. So to start that, and I say that I have Van Gogh's ear for music. I don't know my brass from my oboe, but man, did I really enjoy that wonderful music. And thank you, Eric. I may be most famous for, and this was born in Concord, New Hampshire, the book called Anguished English, titled, and Marcia said titled, not entitled. Thank you, Marcia. Anguished English. And the most famous part of that is The World According to Student Loopers, a collection that I stitched together of fluffs and flubs, boo-boos, bloopers, botches, goofs and gaffes, miscreated by students around the world, but no child of yours, nobody who shares your DNA. And I stitched them into The World According to Student Bloopers, and I'm going to do a little bit of that for you. So it's truly astonishing what havoc students can wreak on the chronicles of the human race. And I have pieced together these bloopers, and here we go. The inhabitants of ancient Egypt lived in the Sahara Desert, which they cultivated by irritation and over which they traveled by Camelot. They all rode in hydraulics, and ancient Egyptian women wore a colossus, a loose-fitting garment, which began just below the breast, which hung to the floor. Marvelous example of a misplaced modifier. From the Egyptians, we naturally moved to the Bible. The Bible is full of many interesting caricatures. Noah's wife was called Joan of Arc. Again, these are written by the hormone sport in the sneakers. Lot's wife was a pillar of salt by day and a ball of fire by night, one of my favorites. This isn't a blooper, but I love it. Why were Adam and Eve the happiest couple in history? It's because she couldn't tell him how many other men she could have married, and he couldn't tell her how much he loved his mother's cooking. Moses went up on Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments, but he died before he ever reached Canada. And incidentally, are you aware that Moses was the first man in history to download data from the cloud to his tablet? any of these that you need again, and you'll see it up on the screen again, I believe, but Richard H. Letterer, don't forget the H, at gmail.com, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that I don't today. There it is, and I'm a teacher, I'm a compulsive sharer, and I will be happy to address, probably within 48 hours, you would get an answer from me from when you send it. So David was a Hebrew king skilled at playing the lyre, L-I-A-R, should be L-Y-R-E. That's a stringed instrument. We get the word lyric from that, the noun, or lyrical, the adjective. Solomon, one of David's sons, had 300 wives and 700 porcupines. I was sorely tempted to add to that one, to whom he made love very carefully, but the student didn't write that, so that is not in the narrative. The Greeks were a highly sculptured people, and without them, we wouldn't have history. The Greeks invented three kinds of columns: Corinthian, Ionic, and Doric. They also invented myths. A myth is a female moth. Boy, do we get that in the humanities teaching. And one myth tells us that the mother of Achilles dipped him in the river Styx until he became intolerable. Socrates was a famous Greek teacher who went around giving people advice. They killed him. Socrates died of an overdose of wedlock. Now, I can hear the laughter erupting all over Monadnock area, Peterborough, etc., and those listening at more far-flung distances. And that is the laughter of educated people. And I don't want to be snooty or snobby. Notice how so many nose words have a snuh, and you do that kind of thing. But when I say the laughter of educated people, I don't mean where did you go? Did you go to college? Where did you go? But I mean people who make learning a lifelong adventure, and as obviously you do as a member of the Monadnock Ledger. And thank you also for your kindness to help keep this series going. So you get it. You get it. Corinthian, Ionic, and Doric. So you hear Corinthian, Ionic, and Doric. And to mix a metaphor, your stomach erupts into a rolling boil because you get what it should be. And with an overdose of wedlock, you may know about Socrates drinking the hemlock. And he was married to Xantippe, who didn't look shrewish, but she was an ultimate shrew. And that, you get that, you know. Life is richer. The more you learn, the more you are educated, the more you make learning a lifelong adventure. So, for example, to stay with the Greeks, what's the difference between a centaur and a senator? And that's a lot of fun because there's only a one-syllable difference. And I would bet that most of you out there, C-E-N-T-A-U-R, you can picture that. So you sort of see what's coming. And the answer, of course, is the difference between a centaur and a senator. One is half man and half horse's ass, and the other is a creature in mythology. Little switcheroo there. Well, eventually the Romans came along and conquered the Greeks. And there's a focus in Anguished English. One of the books I'm pretty sure is at the Toadstool signed. Julius Caesar extinguished himself on the battlefields of Gaul. And when the Ides of March murdered him, he expired with these immortal words upon his dying lips: "Eat you, Brutus." I got that one from a fellow inmate in the House of Correction meeting a fellow English teacher. And just said, oh, that's got to go into the book. The wheel of history turns yet again, and the Romans were overrun by the barbarians. And this takes us into the Middle Ages, when everyone was middle-aged. King Arthur lived in the age of chivalry, with brave knights on prancing horses and beautiful women. Joan of Arc was burned to a stake. I would call that one a rare medium well done, that blooper. People contracted the bluebonnet plague, which caused them to grow boobs on their necks. Magna Carta ensured, with an E incidentally, you can ask me that question if you want, insure, assure, ensure. ensured that no free man should be hanged twice for the same offense, and people perform morality plays about ghosts, goblins, virgins, and other mythical creatures. Then came the Renaissance, an age where people really felt the value of their human being, as you all, members and supporters of the Monadnock Ledger, you feel the value of your human being. This is partially an expression of our humanity. The Renaissance, the rebirth Renaissance, was the time of a great many inventions and discoveries. Gutenberg invented the Bible in removable type. Sir Walter Raleigh discovered cigarettes and started smoking. And Sir Francis Drake circumcised the world with a 100-foot clipper. My favorite blooper in Anguished English, incidentally. So let's do a little American bloopered history. The world of America, according to bloopers. During the Renaissance, America began. Christopher Columbus discovered America while cursing about the Atlantic on the Nina, the Pinta Colada, and the Santa Fe. Jumping a bit in the narrative, Abraham Lincoln became America's greatest president. Lincoln's mother died in infancy, and he was born in a log cabin, which he built with his very own hands. Abraham Lincoln wrote the Gettysburg Address while traveling from Washington to Gettysburg on the back of an envelope. Envelope is preferred American spelling. So once again, see structurally what's wrong there. Abraham Lincoln wrote the Gettysburg Address while traveling from Washington to Gettysburg on the back of an envelope. And of course, that kind of nesting prepositional phrase within a longer prepositional phrase, on the back of an envelope, is in the wrong place. You want to locate your modifiers, whether they be single words or phrases or clauses, as close as possible to that which they purport to modify. And I'm going to give you three examples of the hot water you can fall into if you misplace your modifiers and dangle your participles in public. These are all true. And here we go. Late 80s, TV Guide. Yoko Ono talks about her husband, John Lennon, who was killed in an interview with Barbara Walters. See the problem with that prepositional phrase? Boy, that Barbara Walters. Boston Globe, pretty near you all. Former hostage Terry Anderson talks about his 5 years of captivity with Barbara Walters on Channel 5 at 10 p.m. What an image. And then finally, Associated Press, National. The diving and amateur sports communities remained in shock today following revelations from Olympic diver Greg Louganis, who talks freely of his having contracted AIDS in a 2020 interview with Barbara Walters. If any of you would like the entire World According to Student Bloopers, you email me again at Richard H. Letter, pretty easy address except for the H in the middle, at gmail.com, and spelled phonetically. My last name, incidentally, means leather worker, leder as in lederhosen, lederhosen, and the ER at the end is what we call a noun agency suffix. And one who works with leather. It's the German equivalent of Skinner and Tanner. And a lot of this learning, I have to tell you, was at University of New Hampshire. I entered in the second year of their PhD program and did my dissertation on English word making and how the atoms that we call morphemes, I became a morpheme addict, coalesce and harmonize to become the molecules we call words. It changed my life. Let's talk a little bit about age, because I suspect that many of my friends out there in the audience are chronologically gifted, chronologically endowed. So I want to say two things about, well, sort of our age group. We hear us called seniors, of course, things like geezers and so on. I have come up with the word perennials, I think Marcia would like that, love that, because she is the quintessential gardener. And I know spends a lot of time because she's a cultivated woman with a fertile mind. But at any rate, perennials keep on blooming, not every minute, every time, but for a very long time. So I'd like to think we're perennial. So I'm going to start with this. About a month ago from this esteemed occasion, my celestial odometer flipped over to the age of 83. But even at 82, I had been alive for slightly more than one-third the life, the number of years that our nation, that the United States has been a nation. Let me say that again. At 82, and certainly at 83, I had been on this earth alive for more than a third, just a tad, that's from Tadpole, incidentally, more than a third of the number of years that America has been a nation. So let's do the math. 1776 to 2021 is 245 years. 82 times 3 is 246 years. And then, of course, at least come July 4th, 83 will take it to 249. So you see, I have lived one third and a little bit more of the life of our nation. So here is a second aspect of age. Back in 1981, Ronald Wilson Reagan entered the Oval Office as the oldest, most chronologically endowed man to do so. He was 69 years, 11 months, and 2 weeks, on the cusp of 70 years old. He since has been superseded by Donald Trump, who entered the office at 70 years and 2 months, and then, of course, by Joe Biden, who entered at 78 and 4 months, sorry, with Trump, and with Joe Biden, 78 and 2 months to the day, because he happened to have been born on November 20th. So the point is that we're just living longer and more vitally. You know, we have a 50-year-old, by the way, from San Diego, where I live, just won the PGA. 43-year-old quarterback won the Super Bowl recently. And we have three men in their 30s who have won 59 majors in tennis. But the point is that Joe Biden entered the Oval Office older than Ronald Reagan left it, even after those extra 8 years. So I am International Punster of the Year, as I think the lovely Marcia mentioned. So I'm going to inflict a couple of puns on you, and we'll have some fun. So all of you, I am sure, have heard of Quasimodo. I don't mean the real Modo. I'm talking about the Quasimodo. The Quasimodo. Not the quarterback of Notre Dame, not the halfback of Notre Dame, not the fullback of Notre Dame, but the hunchback of Notre Dame. And just to be sure, this is one of the many advantages of the Monadnock Lyceum. I am going to teach you how to make a Quasimodo face. So everyone out there, and actually I can see you, so here we go. I want you to take your index fingers, that's everyone, including the host. I want you to pull down on your eyes, and I want you to pull up on your nose so you look like this. Okay? Look at this. It's very versatile. This is Quasimodo, Phantom of the Opera. See, very, very, very versatile. So here we go there, and now you know how to make a Quasimodo face. You can let go. Uh-oh, Marcia, I have some bad news for you. I think you are stuck and you may not be able to get rid of it. Well, Quasimodo grows too old to ring the bell. So he puts out an ad in the paper, wanted bell ringer. He opens the door and the next to his home. And the next day, out on the front stoop, there is a gentleman who, no arms, and I can't really show you that well because I'm sitting down, but I'm putting my arms behind me. No arms. a totally disarming fellow. And Quasimodo says, Sarah, wait a minute, are you here for the job of Vellringer? Yes, I am. Well, sir, I have to ask you, you evince a prominent lack of appendages in the upper torso area. How do you propose to ring the bell? And the man said, well, I may have no arms, but I have a very tough forehead. I run at the bell. I strike the bell with my forehead, and it emits a gorgeous, exquisite, sonorous, one might even say tintinabulating sound. I throw in tintinabulating because I know you're a learned audience, and some of you may well recognize that from Edgar Allan Poe's The Bells, one of the most famous poems in our language. The Bells. If you like poetry, P-O-E-T-R-Y, then you want to try Poe, T-R-Y-P-O-E. That is called a fortunate reversal. See, I'm sneaking in learning wherever possible. So the armless fellow mounts the obligatory spiral staircase up into the tower, looks at the bell, runs at it, bong! Of course, he couldn't do this with a bong. Gorgeous, exquisite, sonorous, beautiful, tintinabulating. But the bell is on a lever. It swings back, clops him in the head, knocks him out of the tower. He flies through the air, and he splatters on the cobblestones below. Well, the police come. Mr. Quasimodo. Yes? Do you know this man? Yes, I do. He was an employee of mine. Well, for our records, could you give us his name? And you know what Quasimodo says? I don't know his name, but his face rings a bell. My gosh, your laughter is just shaking the books on my bookshelf behind me. This is my study where I do my my loving labors in the crop of words, the land of words. Well, wait a minute. You're not off that easy because you're getting a second one. So now Quasimodo has to get a new bell ringer. He puts out an ad in the paper, wanted bell ringer. And the next day he opens the front door, and on his stoop, there's a second guy who, again, is disarming. No arms. Quasimodo says, wait a minute, are you here for the job of bell ringer? Yes, I am, the fellow says. And not only is he disarming, but he looks exactly like the previous guy. Quasimodo says, well, I've got two questions to ask. First of all, you look remarkably like a gentleman who was recently in my employ, but who jumped to a conclusion. And the man says, well, I'm not surprised you say that. That man was my older brother. We looked so much alike, everybody thought we were twins. But no, actually, he was 3 years older. And so I'm younger, so we're not twins. Well, sir, like your deceased brother, you evince a prominent lack of appendages in the upper torso area. So I have to ask you, how do you propose to ring the bells? Well, like my brother, I have a very tough forehead. I run at the bells. I strike them with my forehead, and they emit a gorgeous, beautiful, sonorous, tintinabulating sound. But I am younger and more athletic than my brother, and when the bell swings back, I get out of the way. You're hired, says Quasimodo. Okay, so that now this man up the obligatory spiral staircase into the bell tower, looks at the bell, runs at it, bang! The bell swings back, and he very athletically sways out of the way. And for 3 days and three nights, the town is treated to exquisite, gorgeous, sonorous, beautiful, tintinabulating bell music. But the third night, the man gets stinking drunk, intoxicated. Look at the root in the middle, toxic, toxicon, Greek. That had to do with the poison arrows that the Greeks employed in warfare. And if one of those poison-coated arrows just grazed you, you were a goner. And the ancient Greeks, in their infinite wisdom, maybe finite wisdom, whatever, knew that drinking could be poison, drinking to excess. So now this drunken guy, he staggers up the staircase into the bell tower and lurches at the bells, but he's so wasted and stinko that he just strikes it a glancing blow. And now the bell comes back, and he can't get out of the way, and clops him in the head. He flies out of the tower, splat on the cobblestones below. The police come. Ah, Mr. Quasimodo, yes. Do you know this man? Yes, he too was in my employ. Well, for our record, can you give us his name? And Quasimodo says, I don't know his name, but he's a dead ringer for his brother. So that's the two of them. I, International Punster of the Year, can assure you that a good pun is like a good steak, a rare medium well done, and a good pun is its own reword. And any material like that, when, you know, gee, send me the pun. Or, I mean, even if I haven't talked about it, I'm interested in the Shakespeare authorship controversy. What do you think about split infinitives and terminal prepositions coming at the end of the sentence? And all of that, you know, and you'll get an answer, you know, not an ongoing correspondence, but I'm very happy because that's what teachers do. We are compulsive sharers. And I remember very fondly my 35 years at St. Paul's School. All three of my children were educated there, and just a lovely time, and all my friends in Concord, I think some of whom are listening here. So I suspect that many of you are readerly, and frankly, I have written Richard Lederer's Ultimate Book of Literary Trivia for you, and that will be start being available to me at least in mid-July, and my Bouncing Baby book. So I would like to share with you, and I am going to when I say I would like. This is the second chapter of the book, and I think this matches a number of you, my friends out there. It's called A Book Lover's Profile. While many fabrics and garments are colored or printed after they are woven, wool is sometimes dyed before it is ever woven or made into cloth. The color of that wool is through and through and impossible to remove completely. So when we say someone is a dyed with the D-Y-E, they dyed in the wool, conservative, liberal, environmentalist, animal rights supporter, Yankee, Red Sox fan, I'll say for you all, we mean that their beliefs are steadfast and permanent. So you know you're a dyed in the wool book lover if you were that kid who got excited when your teacher asked the class to read silently for a half hour. At home, if you got sent to your room as punishment, you snickered to yourself because that meant an opportunity to be alone in peace with a book in your hands and a smile on your face. And I hope that you can hear the music of that series of prepositional phrases at the end. I read all of my work that I'm writing aloud to myself because I want to hear the music that I am hoping is getting across to readers. When you were little, books were your best friends, and they still are. You know the characters in novels better than you know real people. You yearn to live in the books you read, and you wish you could go on adventures with the people in them. You dream about attending Hogwarts, and you wish you could leap inside your wardrobe and travel to Narnia. When you're between books, you feel lost until you get the next one, open the next one. You experience distress when you are somewhere without a book, a magazine, a newspaper, or at least a scrap of paper. The book is always, always, always better than the movie. The stack of books on your night table resembles the beginning of a Jenga game. When you are reading a good book, you sometimes forget to eat or sleep. On a must-finish night, you fall asleep with the book still in your hands. The bags under your eyes are not from a kinetic social life, but from staying up reading into the wee hours. When you work out, you choose only the machines that let you read while you're sweating. You can't figure out what people who go to the beach without a book do there. You spend the majority of your vacation time reading, and that includes your honeymoon. You've read so many books that people don't dare buy them for you anymore. Instead, they give you book-related gift cards, and one of your rapturous joy, I know this is in my life, is when a friend actually reads a book you have recommended and loves it, and loves it. Bookstores are your favorite places no matter where you are or what you're there for. If you come upon a bookstore, you have to go inside and browse. 3 hours later, you emerge with a stack of books in your hands. You can't buy happiness, but you can buy books, and that's pretty much the same thing. You know that reading a new book is like life renewing itself. Okay, I'm going to close with my final pray on words, and then after that, offer a toast to all of you wonderful people. This is an audience participation one, and of course I can't see the audience, but I'm going to count on you and just give it a try, and I'll pretend that I hear you, okay? This is a set of Spoonerisms. William Archibald Spooner, mid-19th century, I think he was born entered the earthly stage in 1832, grew up to become a distinguished professor of divinity, philosophy, literature, and history in the Oxford Yards for 60 years, but to his undying chagrin, was known for his Spoonerisms, his accidental reversal of initial consonants and consonant blends. So, for example, he was a devout Episcopalian, and one day he walked in the church, and there was a woman in his usual spot. He approached her and said, "Maud me, Padam, I am occupying my pie. May I sew you to another sheet?" And I'm guessing that you were able to reverse those because as human beings, that's how you're wired up there. And that is you're wired to make sense of that and to get the puns. Another time, and this is not my closing toast, incidentally, but he hoisted his tankard of ale to Queen Victoria. And he said, "Three cheers for our queer old dean." And of course, you made it "dear old queen" because you're human. That's what you do. And that's what I play upon in my own work. So here we go. And as I do the Spoonerisms, when I do this, this is like Simon Says, then you shout out, admittedly, in your private space, you shout out the what the right word was. So, "Tunce upon a wine," I'll do the first song with you, which would be "Once Upon a Time." The title is "Prinderella and the Sense," which is Cinderella and the Prince. And all I've done is reverse the C and the PR going the other way. "Tunce upon a wine, there lived a greedy little pearl." See, pretty little girl. And her name was Prinderella. She lived with her sticky wet mother and her sugly esters. And they made her pine all the shots and shans, wean all the clindos, and do all the wordy dirk around the house. Isn't that a shirty dame? And I'm hearing dirty shame out there. Well, one day, the ping issued a proclamation that all the geligible earls in the kingdom should come to a drancy fest ball. Fancy dress ball. Prinderella didn't have a drancy fest. All she had was an erdy drag. Dirty rag. So off went the sticket wet mother and the three sugliesters to the drancy fest ball while Prinderella stayed home. And who should appear? And usually I'd be standing up and I would sort of make my pants into a dress, but Prinderella's Gary Fodmother. And the Gary Fodmother quickly turned a pumpkin into a poach, four heists in the morses, and Prinderella's erdy drag into a dragnificent mess. That's a little bit harder. Dragnificent mess, magnificent dress. And the Gary Fodmother said to Prinderella, "Now, Cinderella, you go off to the Trancy Fest Bowl and have a good time. But remember, you gotta be home by the moke of stridnight." Stroke of midnight. Well, off went Prinderella to the Drancy Fest Ball, and dang, she did have a toot gime, because at the Drancy Fest Ball, Prinderella met a Prancum Hints. handsome prince. And she pranced with that dince. Notice I changed one word, so now the initial consonants change, or one of them does. Pranced with that dince all night long, and at the moke of stridnight, Prinderella ran down the palace steps. And what did she do? Now here's the spoonerism. She didn't drop her slipper. What did she do? Now you have to do the spoonerism. She didn't drop her slipper. She slopped her dripper all over the place. Well, the next day, the king issued another proclamation that all the gelgamelers in the kingdom should sly on the tripper. Well, the sticket web mother slid on the tripper. It fitted it. Didn't fit. The three sugliesters slid on the tripper. It fitted it. But Prinderella flipped her soot, slipped her foot into the tripper, and it fitted it. So Prinderella and the Dince Mudgarry got married, and they lived happily ever after. It's actually a triple. Hived happily ever laughter. I use the L twice. And the star of the Mari is, if you want to go to a Drancy Fest ball and meet and marry a Pransom Hence, you better be sure to slop your dripper. A lot of fun. And of course, I have the text of that if you need it. It's been such a privilege and honor to be with the Monadnock Ledger. I'm sorry, that's not right. Lyceum. It just means the world to me. And speaking of Zooming, you know, this is the resilience of humanity. Think 103 years ago where they didn't have this and the isolation that they must have experienced. And now we have this. And it just says something about the power of science and the power of science to bring us all together. If you're interested in some of the etymology on COVID-19 and so on, I've done a lot of the etymology of that, anything that you want to send. So I am going to close with a toast to all of you wonderful people. Why do we call it a toast? Well, I explore that in my aborning book. I've finished now the text, and I'm now putting out proposals to publishers, A Pleasury of Word and Phrase Origins. And we call it a toast because back in the day of Queen Elizabeth I and Willie Wigglestaff, which is a kind of jocular, clever, waggish pun on William Shakespeare, Wigglestaff. Apparently, he had an ancestor who was in the military and shook a spear. It's another occupational surname like mine. But at any rate, back in those days, people would actually place slices of spiced toast, so it's a bread metaphor, into their tankards of ale to improve the flavor and remove the impurities. And you're coming out in such numbers to support this opening of the kickoff, whatever metaphor, of the summer season. I hope you feel that it has enhance the flavor of your life, and maybe you've experienced a small diminution in any bitterness that you might that you might be feeling. So here we go, in honor of Dr. William Archibald Spooner. And remember, a good pun is like a good steak, a rare medium well done, and it is its own reward, as I've said. Here is champagne to our real friends. Here is real pain to our sham friends. Thank you for being good friends to the Monadnock Lyceum and being good friends by having me to our glorious, uproarious, notorious, victorious, outrageous, courageous, contagious, stupendous, tremendous, endless adventure that we call the Angelish from the Angles. The Angelish language. Love you all. Bye.
I'd like to thank you again, Richard, for entertaining and sharing with us this morning of laughter and learning. And we hope the audience has enjoyed, we know they enjoyed, the first program of the 2021 Lyceum series. We hope also that the audience will join us again next week on the 4th of July. We will be here at 10:45 for music, and we will hear Hans Araki discuss and play the Japanese flute. We thank again your participation. And now I'm going to be sharing with Richard some questions that have come on the chat and questions that you've been sending. And I encourage you to continue to email, and we will address as many as we can during the time that we have allotted. And those that are not addressed during that time, we will be forwarding on, or you can send to the email to Richard H. Lederer, and he will get back to you. I'd like to begin with one question that I think often people want to know is, what inspired you to combine humor and language?
Inspire, by the way, means to breathe into. Perspire is to breathe through. Again, dig down to the roots, and I've written about that, and I'm happy to send that to people. What inspired me with my own teachers growing up in Philadelphia, public school system, and then making the leap to Haverford College, one of the Quaker schools with Swarthmore and Bryn Mawr outside of Philadelphia. I entered as a chemistry major, but I soon found I was reading the formulae and the valences for their literary value when I switched over to English, and that's sort of on my way. And then when I started teaching at St. Paul's School, and I was in Concord for 35 years, 27 of them at there, I went there because it's an Episcopal school, and if you take every letter, and no more, no fewer, in the word Episcopal, you get two sweet things, a Pepsi-Cola and a Popsicle. You have to include the A. So I do things for strange motives. But what I found early on is that learning dressed up to have fun, that is learning and humor, teaching and humor are great team teachers. And the students seem to like that, and it's my nature anyway. And therefore, I think they work together, and I do that in just about all my books, including the literary trivia one. There's a lot of humor in that. And I'm going to keep these relatively short because time's winged chariot hurries near, Andrew Marvell. Yes. And at my back, I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near. Yes, next. Thank you for the question.
Another question comes and says, what do you see as the future of puns and language humor as we get more and more into a generation who uses and is most comfortable with abbreviated spelling in email?
Boy, good question. I think puns are alive and well and living in the language, in part because we live in a culture that values them, you know. So we tend to be suspicious of each new medium, Marcia, that comes along, okay? So going back to Socrates, who never wrote anything down, he had Plato to do that, but he was completely oral. He said in, I think it was Phaedrus in that dialogue, the invention of the alphabet will dull men's minds and destroy their memories. Remember, the Iliad was not written down, and it was orally passed on, you know, from one person, human, to another. And we know now that the invention of the alphabet has enriched, and I'm very optimistic rather than misty-optic about, you know, the texting and all of that, which I do myself, and certainly makes the writing more concise. So I'm optimistic, and I think the puns will remain.
That's encouraging. I have an academic question here. A gentleman wants to know, are you an Oxford comma guy? And you might explain what an Oxford comma is.
My pleasure. Also known as the Harvard comma, a little closer to you, and the serial comma. I sure am, sir. Thank you for asking. And the book Comma Sense, which Marcia was kind enough to mention, I am just a strong supporter. So the Oxford, we'll stay with that. The Oxford comma is, do you put the comma before the and or not? Our flag is red, comma, white, and blue. Well, what do we do with the there? And what we do is we do should put a comma in, unless you're writing for certain magazines and almost all newspapers. So for my column, Letter on Language, I don't put it in and it kills me, but I don't want the editor to have to take it out. Reason number one, why does punctuation exist? To mirror, reflect the cadence of the language. So we say the flag is red, white, and blue, meaning there's a level, similar pause after red and after white. We don't say the flag is red, white, and blue. It's the flag is red, white, and blue. That's what the second comma is there for. Second, and I can send anybody who wants only a lot of examples I collected, funny, of course. And I'll just do one. And I'm thinking only in honor of what's Willard Williams. Is that his name, Marcia? The bookstore guy.
I believe so. I know him as Willard.
Willard, yeah. At any rate, a famous book dedication, and this is how it went. To my parents, comma, the Pope and Mother Teresa. Now, there's no comma after Pope there, so you may notice a bit of a problem, because without the comma, it looks like to my parents, the Pope, and to my parents, comma, and then it looks like the Pope and Mother Teresa are in apposition, what we call in a positive. If you put in to my parents, comma, the Pope, comma, and Mother Teresa, it's clear that there are four people, not two. So A, for the cadence, and second, for clarity, absolutely huge fan of the Oxford comma. If any of you want to know more about that, you know, if you email me, just be a little bit specific. If you don't write and say, gee, I'd like you to send me what you said today. That's just way too much. But home in, not hone in, and I'll be happy to help. So that's great. God, so far the questions are terrific. And hey, as I understand, Marcia, I still have 2 hours to do this. What's the next one? I'm kidding, Marcia.
I have a question here that says, have you found any interesting language changes between the older Bible and the more modern translations, things that you find interesting as a linguist?
Yeah, and there I'm just not qualified. The answer is certainly changes, but I am not qualified to answer that question, so I won't. But I'm sure there are, I just don't know them specifically. And one sixth of the literature book is on Bible, some amazing things about it.
You want to share a couple with us as a teaser?
Well, the best-selling book of all times, Shakespeare is hiding in the Bible in a very interesting way that you'll find out. It's just a compendium of stories and philosophy and proverbs and this and that. Amazing. And anybody who wants to see all that stuff about it, I will be happy to send it. And of course, I have my Bible jokes there, as you see. I gave a few.
I have a thank you from a commenter who says she has enjoyed and chuckled through many years over the picture of the Queen of England sitting on her thorn for
years. That is also Anguished English, a very well illustrated book. That is in like its fourth or fifth iteration, and by the way, has spawned, and people on my website can find this, of course, there are actually 5 Anguished English books now, and they're on the website, just because the first one is the spark plug of my career. I mean, it sold 1 million copies, and it was born in Concord, New Hampshire, and it started with a couple of columns that I wrote on these. I was getting these bloopers, and for the Concord Monitor, Marcia, I had it 2 weeks in a row, the world according to student bloopers. A publisher called from Charleston, South Carolina, had seen it because his niece had worked at the library, the state library in Concord. And that's what happens. You know, you lose all the points in life you don't play. And it led to that. And that was the first of now 54 books that I've written. Stop me before I write again. And I'm happiest when I'm doing it. You know, no number that I wanted to reach. As I say, 83, I'm sure many of you would feel that I don't look a day over 93, but I'm 83. And all I can say is, and one of the nice things about being 83, my dear friends, is you're all the other ages. And they come back to me. I like that, being all the ages. Obviously, I'm mainly this age, but I really like all the others. So wonderful questions. And any more there, Marcia, that I can be helpful with?
Here's one that's been in the news lately. How do you handle plural pronouns used in a singular context?
Absolutely. And you're thinking of they especially, yes. I think. Okay. And I'm looking at the clock. And actually, it's going to be up to you to cut me off, you know. Here we go. By the way, I've written on this, and I would love to send it to you. It's called Sex in the Singular Pronoun. And we've noticed that they is already strongly being used not only as a third person plural, but also a third person singular. Okay?
Okay.
I'm all for it. And here's why. One historical precedent, I trace that back. There's even an instance in Chaucer, who lived 1340 to 1400. So, but you see it in Shakespeare and others. Marcia, you're looking a little distracted.
I'm going to cut you here.
Oh.
Only because we have a time constraint, and do not leave, because we are going to continue. If your questions were not answered, we are going to continue. You can follow, but the part that is being recorded on our website will contain all of the questions and answers, but the part that's going to the radio programs has a more rigid time frame. So again, I want to thank Eric Stumacher for his piano sharing. I want to thank the RBC for their sponsorship. And I want to encourage everyone who can to join us again 10:45 next Sunday. It is July 4th. We're going to be here celebrating. So please come and see us. And for those of you who can stay, and I invite you to continue sending questions for the next few minutes. The questions can be on grammar, usage, phrase origins, and I have one right here that talked about the COVID-19 language that you mentioned you had been doing some research.
Well, what I'm going to do, if it's okay, is finish on they.
Yes.
And then I'll do some COVID-19 the best I can. So on they, as I said, there's historical precedent, and the best writers do it. And second, we do it. So Marcia, here's the kind of joke you would enjoy. You're sitting at a table and you order, and the server goes to, you know, fill the order, and you wait and wait and wait. And finally the server comes back with the food maybe 15 minutes later. And the question is, why are they called the waiter when you're doing the waiting? Why? Right. Funny. But notice I said they after I talked about server. I went from singular to plural, and I didn't hear the bat of an eye from anybody, because we do it. The cellular customer you are trying to reach is not at their station, and nobody goes, wait a minute, you went from singular to plural. And one of the reasons that we don't bat an eye or break a pencil point or whatever is, Marcia, we're already doing it with the word you. We already have a second person singular and plural. Now, what it used to be there is thou shalt not steal was one person. You, and so on. Thou shalt not. And ye was a bunch of thous. Oh, ye of little faith meant a bunch of thous. Well, notice what happened there. Those were separated, and now we have you for both of them. And language is allowed to do that. So that's another reason why I welcome it. And incidentally, as of, I think, 2017, all the major dictionaries have they a singular and plural? And of course, the last one is that we live at a time when people who have different gender identities and are non-binary, they have more freedom to express who they are and use they, their, and so on, theirs, them, as the pronoun for them, rather than specifically masculine and feminine. And I like them to have that freedom. That's what language should do. So that's the answer. So now, if you would re-ask that other question.
Yes, there was a question about the language on COVID-19.
Right.
Could you address that?
Well, I will. You know, COVID came in and I coronavirus disease, I think is the D, and the 19 hyphen was the year that it came in. I always joke that that 19 was the average amount of weight that people would gain during the isolation, but it happens that I believe that number is 29. I've heard that from several sources. So, you know, who knows? A number of words, and I'm just gonna give you one, at least right now. So we're on what I guess is called Zoom, although I think it's a different method. So there's an interesting answer. Can you use Zoom generically, like, you know, Kleenex and Magic Marker, which are brand names? At any rate, two of my favorites are what are called portmanteau words, where you blend at the middle. And one of them is for people who behave irresponsibly were out partying when the pestilence was raging, COVIDiots. So COVID and idiot, and you put them together. Another one is Blursday, because I think we all experienced, you know, during the isolation, and I believe it did not hit Merrimack County as hard as other places, but at any rate, Blursday is you get up and you say, wait a minute, is this Tuesday or Wednesday? You have to check your watch, your computer. But that is a marvelous one. And then going back to the Zoom, the word unmute, I would posit, came in with this technology. And essentially, we got to know unmute during the Armageddon. Now, we had the word mute as a verb. And we had the word mute, of course, as an adjective. But as a verb, you mute your trumpet and you put something over the front part of it. But unmute, you don't unmute a Trump. You unmute when you're doing Zoom. And there's an example of how science and technology gives us a new word that I do not believe has existed there. And I'll just do a pun on COVID and we'll move on in any way you want. You know, 25 years ago, it's going to be a sextuple pun. 25 years ago, let me just get this back in my mind. Steve Jobs was alive, right? Johnny Cash was alive and Bob Hope was alive. Now, alas, we have no Jobs, no Cash, and no Hope. Let us pray mightily that Meatloaf, I'm just getting this back in my head, Meatloaf, Kevin Bacon, and John Hamm do not die. So a triple pun on names.
I love it. I have a question here that has to do with, do you think, could you define, or what would you call standard English now, as contrasted to, or maybe inclusive of, coarse language, vulgar language? How do you see, are there strict divisions? What do you see as standard English?
Okay, let me start with this. Language is a great pie, the slices of which are dialects, and standard English is one of them. It's a dialect, but it's a very important one. Yeah, we all speak dialects, and you may hear some of my pronunciation of water, and I actually try to keep that because I was born in Philadelphia. I was there my first decades. So standard English is a dialect, but it's a very important one. It's the language in which most books are written. It's the language in which most broadcasts are cast. And I say that because, again, in the suborning book and a little bit Marcia, in your area, to broadcast came before radio, and it meant to broadly cast your seed over soil. And that's how we got it. And then when radio started doing that on the air, they called that a broadcast, but they got that from a much earlier word. So, and my recommendation, caring, is folks out there, you should master standard English as best you can if you want to reap the full fruits of American civilization. And that doesn't mean that you throw away your other dialect, and you use it where appropriate in that community. And I would also include quote unquote Black English, which is a perfectly rich, rule governed language that is one of our dialects. And it is not a weak reflection of standard English. It has its own rules and a very, very rich history. I could go on and on, but I'm not going to in this context. So now, coarse English, I think, I would think that could be part of standard. I'm not going to obviously do coarse English. You have to look at the cunning linguist, but I would say it could be part of any of those dialects that is standard or otherwise. So that would be my answer.
Interesting. I have a question about punctuation marks, such as apostrophes or even commas. Do you think some of them will disappear? Do you think some of them should disappear?
In England, definitely the apostrophes are disappearing. I would prefer that they don't, but to some extent they do. The Victorian sentence, Marcia and the contributor, was almost twice as long as the average sentence today and had many more semicolons. And if you read Victorian, particularly essays, you see, because again, they didn't have TV, radio, and basically reading was an even bigger thing. The apostrophe, I call them, because they're so misused, prepostrophes. And you see them either for plural, apples, and it's A-P-P-L-E. Oh, there's an S, we got to do a squiggle. And it's often with an apostrophe that shouldn't have it. And if anybody wants advice on using apostrophes, certainly write me, and I'll give you a number of examples. So I think they're very useful, all of them, and some are pretty rare. I, as a writer, the M dash, which people call hyphens dashes. They're not. Hyphens are hyphens, and dashes are twice as long hyphens. But they like, American English likes single words. Mm. So I think we may lose some apostrophes, but I hope we won't. But I think, periods and so on. And I think we use ellipses, points, brackets, less than we used to, but they're still there. And they're very important for your reader. It's respect for your reader.
Mm. What about capitalization? Do you see that changing?
Well, there's pressure on it, of course, because we do our email addresses in lowercase caps. You know what a great example is, Marcia? Internet. About 2 years ago, it went to a small I, and I use that because it's not a corporation. Before that, internet was capital I. Now it's small I, and one should write it as a small I. I think there will be some diminution of capital letters. And what's lovely is these are very thoughtful questions, people who think about language and how it looks and sounds. Great.
One of the things that you are writing and working on are phrase origins. Could you share with us some of your favorites or some of the most interesting that you've come across? Wow. Or some that people use and they use in a way that shows they have no idea what the origin meant.
Wow. Okay. Well, this is fun for me, of course. People have been asking me for decades to write the etymology book. And I have said, well, I do a kind of I do that in a number of my books, but I've never done a whole book, and now I have. And what I did here is just rather than go A to Z, I go with 12 thematic clusters that that have about 5 or 6 chapters, so they're all connected. So one of them is the body, and all sorts of interesting things, you know, on the body part. One of the great fun is humerus, as in H-U-M-E-R-U-S, you know, that bone that runs down here, and when you strike it, and somebody knew that it sounded like humerus with an O-U-S, so they called it the funny bone, just as one example. But it's the humerus, and that's how it got its name. The eye, I'll just do one more. I could go on and on forever, and as long as you let me, I'm not leaving, because I'm so energized. Do you ever wonder why pupil is both the opening in the eyes and the young student in the classroom? Well, it's because the Romans, I believe it's from pupillus, called this the pupil, but then they notice that a very young child, when the reflection was, well, when the image was reflected in the eyes, the child was small, so they called that kid the pupil, from the little in the eye. Then we go to land, sea, air, and beyond. So let's just take the moon. A lunatic is you're struck by the moon, you're moonstruck, you are daft, and that's where we get lunatic. And look down, and these are not on your toenails, but you'll see that little white curve in your fingernails, you know, where they meet the finger. That's called a lunule, a little moon. Oh. And on and on and on.
I'm going to let that be the teaser for us to go and get that. I look forward to that book on origins. And again, I am sorry that we can't go on, but I really want people to take their questions that weren't answered, address them to richardhletterer@gmail.com. Visit the website, verbifor.com. Go to the toadstool and get a signed book. Thank you, Dr. Letterer. It's been an entire privilege for me to get to speak with you, and a fun way to start a Sunday morning in a world of a lot of trouble. This is a good laugh. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.